Welcome to After Hours by Red Compass Labs, where the best and brightest of the financial services industry let their hair down, unbutton their collars, and share their passion for payments with Julie and Mike. I'm Julie Guetta, Head of Payments Innovation at Red Compass Labs, and I'm joined by my friend and colleague Mike Trotter, an evangelist for digital ecosystems and innovation at Red Compass Labs also. This season, we decided to keep the expertise and carry on focusing on the future of payments, but decided to change the format to spice things up. For most of the episodes, it will be Mike and I enjoying an after-hours chat about the future of payments. But when our crystal balls are telling us conflicting stories, we will invite guests onto the show to help settle our differing points of view. As always, like the Scottish knife, the skin on do, we will try to keep our discussions short, sharp, and to the point, but we can't make any guarantees. So without any script or preparation, let's kick things off.
Today is a very special day. The 8th of March is International Women's Day. To celebrate and support this, we wanted to release a special After Hours podcast dedicated to women's inclusion. To discuss this topic, Julie and I are joined by two extremely special guests, Alison Grun, founder of FreeW. Alison is based in Malaysia and teaches women how to drive and take care of motorbikes. She also organizes road trips to meet women in various regions of the world like Nepal, India, and Iran. Our second guest is Jai, the founder of MoWo, which is a contraction of Moving Women. Jai is based in India. She also teaches women in India how to drive on two or three wheels and organizes workshops for women to discuss how public space could be accessed differently to include everyone safely. Alison, Jai, welcome to the podcast and thank you so much for joining us today. It really is a pleasure to have you on our podcast to discuss a very important topic, women's inclusion. Actually, financial inclusion and sustainability drive the actions of Red Compass Labs. Our mission statement is to open the doors of finance to all and protect those who enter. We feel that society can only really prosper if everyone is included, and of course that includes women. Jai, on MoWo's website, it says 1 million women can drive on the roads by 2030. I couldn't help noticing the link with the 2030 Sustainable Development Goals. Is that intentional? Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, thanks, Mike, for the wonderful introduction. So happy to be here. So professionally, I was an architect, but something moved me when I was on one of the motorcycle expeditions all the way from India to Vietnam. I saw a couple of women as bike taxi riders, and then I thought to myself, why can't we do this back in India? And then typically we say if we want to bring in a change, if, for example, when we are going on the roads, a lot of people say that 1 in 1 million women can ride motorcycles. Of course, that's changing slowly, but it's always...
One in a million?
Yeah, that's how people would notice you, but if we have to change that, then we have to normalize. So we believe in enabling 1 million women, so women riding on the roads becomes a norm. And for a change like this, I just thought we at least need a decade. And it so happened that it matched with the 2030 sustainable goals. But it was not intentional, but it turned out to be so. So that's our goal. Yeah.
Okay. So maybe Alison, you and Jai both see mobility as a main criteria for women's empowerment. Maybe you can expand a little bit more on this and explain why you think mobility is so key for women's empowerment.
Well, there are two parts in the questions. I think mobility is one thing, but I would go even further in the sense that for me, mobility is also a tool to emancipation and self-empowerment and confidence, which I think is one of the really key prerequisites in women's equality and women empowerment. It's for us to get rid of our own self-limiting beliefs and fears. Okay. But when it comes to mobility, well, something that really kind of struck me, I was traveling in Nepal and doing a motorcycle tour. And at some point, one of the guys who was with me was carrying a little boy behind his back. And so when we stopped to the next village, I asked him, why do you have this kid with you? Like, do you have a kid on the tour now? And he said, no, but you know, we, the village before where we stopped, the mother, she has a small bike of her husband, but she cannot ride and the son is very sick. And so she asked me to bring the son to the nearby hospital. And suddenly it struck me, like, for me, mobility and transport, individual transport or public transport, was just like a given, a little bit like financial services. You know, when you have access to this, you think it's standard and it's like a given. But then I realized that there were so many women, especially in rural areas or in different parts of the country and the world, who actually don't have access to mobility. And I realized how it can change the life. And then, of course, on economic opportunities too, because when you can ride, you can not only potentially create a livelihood opportunity in, you know, driving a taxi or delivery, or but also simply accessing your work. Because some women, again, I talked to women in Pakistan, in Bangladesh, they said, they told me, you know, it was a life-saving to ride a bike because I was riding public transport, but then I would have to wait hours to get a seat or it was not safe. And to go to my job, I would spend maybe 4 hours in transport. So having my own motorcycle was life-changing. So yeah, for me, it has a lot of impact, mobility.
That's amazing. Lovely. Julie, you've been very quiet.
Yeah, indeed. I'm just listening to, like, you know, what Alison and Jay are doing, and I found it very inspiring. But it's interesting because, like, before I basically met Alison, like, for me, women's inclusion always, like, you know, was linked to payment and financial inclusion, because I believe that if you have means to, like, you know, do payment, accept payment, budget, manage, like, your money, then you're independent. And then, yeah, Alison told me these stories and so on. And then I realized, oh, actually, like, you were missing one key point, which is mobility. Because you can have, like, you know, all the money and your business, but if you're not able to actually move to either, like, you know, purchase the supply chain that you need to, or, like, you know, put the money in the bank that you need to, because unfortunately not everyone is, like, using digital payment, and still of, like, you know, rural area, it's mainly cash. So at some point, like, you know, this money needs to transit and so on. Actually, without mobility, you're stuck. So it made me realize that it's two sides of the same coin, and these two elements are actually, like, very, very critical. And yeah, that was the conclusion, like, you know, of the discussion we had, that yeah, very important element.
Okay. So actually, you know, maybe Alison and Jai, you know, you've heard Julie and I often talk about payments and how important we think it is. As local entrepreneurs in Malaysia and India, can you share a little bit about your experience? You know, I love the way you've shared about, like, you having that realization, you know, that mobility is a key part. But I think again, many people don't realize, you know, like financial services, Alison, your point was brilliant. You know, if you don't have it, you just don't realize what's missing. Can you give us a perspective of what things are like, you know, from where you are in the world?
You want to start, Jai? I think you have quite a few experiences. You remember when I wanted to sponsor a woman myself, when I wanted to send you money. I think India is a case in point about the difficulties of payments.
I could go. Yeah, so typically, like Alison has mentioned earlier, we all have it, like, I mean, for us, it's so accessible, most of these things. So we almost often take it for granted, not like truly granted, but if, like, you know, I can go around the world. Today I'm sitting in the US and I know that I just have my phone. And, you know, these days we don't have to feel the urge to carry a wallet, because we know we could do so many digital payments. And even back home in India now, it's in the boom of digital payments. Like, we don't use the credit cards and the debit cards much, especially during the pandemic. It also gave us an opportunity to just go digital. Everything we book on the phone, be it the taxi to a grocery or pick up some food or med. But it pains me deeply when we see that there's so many women who are now slowly getting to having a basic smartphone. which probably has the key communication aspects, but still not ventured into having a digital payment mode, which is typically attached to their own banks these days. But most of the women don't even know that this space exists. Forget about using it, but they have no awareness that how simple it can be to use digital payments. And in the space where we are working, it becomes very, very important, because the whole idea of mobility is not just for personal commute, but also in today's rapidly growing mobility economy, there are a lot of livelihood opportunities which are actually very flexible for women to work and also give a decent livelihood or the earnings out of it. And when these kind of livelihood opportunities are opening up in mobility, what it also means is most of these payments, 90% are done digitally. Like all the apps, they would definitely want everyone to get used to the digital payments, except in cases where there is some technical issue, and then probably they would do cash. But one main reason why women stay away from picking up livelihoods in this sector and be a part of this economy is not that they don't know driving. They know driving, but they just get very worked up when they feel that, how can I take money through my phone? Like, I don't know. I'm not tech savvy. I just cannot understand. Like, I'm so illiterate in that. So there's just a lack of awareness. And that's one thing which just stops them from being a part of this whole industry and better livelihoods. So I see it from that side, from where I come from.
And you know, like, that's very interesting, the point you made, because like Mike and I discuss often about this, that we think that actually the point like that is missing with financial inclusion is not only technology, right? As you mentioned, it's not only like having access to the means, it's also understand what are the payment rail, what you can do, and so on. So more financial literacy. And this, unfortunately, like in many geography, whether it's developing country or developed country, it's missing. And like when you mention it, like it pains me even more. And I'm like thinking we should really do even more in financial literacy, because thinking this is the only, like, you know, blocker for actually, like, you know, a woman to get into work and like, you know, increase the budget of the family and probably, like, you know, get children to school and so on. That's really a shame. So.
And it creates equality, right? Because I think still, you know, I'm thinking maybe a generation or two ago where, you know, finance was a man's job and, you know, the woman's job was something else. I think, you know, part of that is education and helping people to have, you know, everyone should know the same stuff, right? Without it, there'll always be that power divide for me, you know, where people who don't know don't have access to the opportunities that the people who do. And that's critical to close that gap, because if we don't address that, then that gap will just remain, right?
And I think it's also the consequences of the gap, right? So like, okay, you're using a certain means of payments today, and then through this means of payment, you build credit scoring as well, so that then, like, you know, you can like get a loan or get a mortgage, and then like potentially or a micro loan, and then improve, extend or scale your business, right? So I think for me, it's like, it's a ripple effect of what you mentioned are like way wider than like we anticipate.
Yeah. I think I agree. I think it's very, very important, the education. And you mentioned as well what you're doing at Red Compass about protection. Because one of the, what I've seen, because I used to work in the fintech space as well and with microfinance institutions, and what we've seen as well as a big risk in finance is that in a way the democratization of finance and digital finance also potentially puts less educated people at risk, because now on those who are digitally comfortable, they are not necessarily financially comfortable, and so they get like quick loans that they can get from their mobiles very easily, you know, when you buy a phone card or something like that, micro loans that just at the tip of your finger. And there has been a lot of cases of major indebtedness, and you know, I'm sorry, but quite a lot of men especially doing that to buy alcohol, because now it's easy to buy payment cashless and take a really quick loans with huge interest. So So I agree with you, like the financial literacy and the support of accompanying organizations on the ground who can help people and women in particular use those tools, but to their benefits and also protect themselves is super important. But another thing I'd like to add as well, because that's also something we discussed with Jai and Julie, here we're looking at the beneficiary, right? The woman that we want to support in mobility. But you also ask about entrepreneurs, so people like us, like Jai. And I wanted to add something about international payments. So I have a few cases where it's been really painful. So for example, it's true in India, there is a huge ecosystem of payments, but it's very closed. So I used to work in India, go every month, and I could not make any payments. I had to download the local app, I had to have the local bank account. And so if you stay within India, it's perfect. But when I wanted to send money to Jai, to sponsor a woman's training, I could not. My bank was not listed on the website. I didn't have any, you know, unless you have a huge cost of bank transfers. Another case is I'm using motorcycle events, online events. And I offer the opportunities to women riders all around the world who come to those events to give a donation if they want to sponsor motorcycle classes. I do that on Eventbrite, and behind is PayPal. Okay, great. PayPal is international. The fees are supposed to be low. Yeah, but the problem is that in Malaysia, it's not really used. So it's super expensive. So I pay to receive the money, and then I pay again to retrieve the money, even on PayPal. You know, and my last case is in Nepal. I did a crowdfunding platform to raise funds to sponsor four women to do a motorcycle tour in Nepal. Again, I lost nearly 15% of the fees through bank transfer. And I used Wise. Wise is supposed to be cheap, yes, but you know, I had the crowdfunding platform fees and the exchange rate and the fees. And so for me as an entrepreneur, and I think Jai as well, who's working quite extensively internationally as well, as long as we are in our own country, that's fine. But everything that we are doing now is also trying to bring international awareness and also getting support from networks outside our country. And when it comes to finance and payment, that becomes a real pain.
Fantastic points. And you've touched on so many important points there. And you know, Julie and I often talk about closed loop, open loop, why that's important, why it should be easy to move between these little pools of liquidity, right? Because the costs are really high, and your case is exactly that point of what we want to change, and part of the reason why we're part of the Module Loop Foundation as well, and part of that partnership to try and break exactly that that kind of concern. But Julie, I wondered if you could touch a little bit on the kind of G20 initiatives. It's specifically targeted at this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, to be fair, what you mentioned, like, it's a problem, right? Because at the end of the day, there is no border anymore. I think we saw it in 2020 with like COVID spreading all across the world, right? But when it comes to payment, these borders still exist. And they are actually like very, very thick in the sense that it's basically hard to get like money through without like losing a bit of the final amount on cost and fees, as you mentioned. And I think there is like, you know, a global realization around this. And this is the agenda that Mike is referring to from the G20. So from the G20, which put like, you know, a high priority, I mean, the Saudi one, puts a high priority on how do we make like cross-border payment more seamless and also cheaper? Because the reality is like today, they are too expensive. So even some fintechs, and you mentioned Wise, try to disrupt the market. But the reality is like a lot of these fintechs, they are tackling specific currency corridors, right? So yeah. as soon as you touch an exotic currency, and unfortunately, Malaysia is often considered like, you know, as an exotic country in this sense because you don't have as many volume, then the cost like are actually like very, very high. And just maybe like to give some perspective on this. So their commitment was to say, we will do the global average cost to 5%. And even 5%, this is a lot of money, right? But today it's at 6.30% globally. Obviously you have some variance from one country to another, but that's still too high. And I mean, we're talking about this has lots of ripple effects again, because one, obviously it's a cost you need to absorb. So what you're gonna do, you're gonna price your service higher. Then you're reducing the potential audience. And when you talk to services that are actually around inclusion, it's preventing you to reach your purpose. I think it's effectively quite critical to work on this. And to be fair, like I said, so when we had this discussion and this one around what are the payment means that could be used for international payment and so on. Like I said, Wise is a good solution. It's one of the fintech, you have other, but most of these fintech are focused on developed country, because again, this is
high transaction volumes.
Yes, and cheaper, way to achieve this. Again, it depends on how advanced is the ecosystem. I think in Malaysia, though, hopefully to change a bit, because the country is going through digital license and so on for banking. So that should bring a bit more competition. And I think there is also some drive all over Southeast Asia to create more interoperability between payment system, which is one of the reasons why the costs are high, right? If it costs money to process a payment, then of course, again, we're coming back to high cost, high price on the market as well. So hopefully it should change a bit, and definitely it's a high priority for the G20.
Yeah, very, very good points there. It's real friction. And I think that friction also potentially is limiting the growth of some of those markets, particularly when you look at trade across borders. It's much easier to just trade inside your own economy, but actually real growth happens when cash crosses borders, when goods cross borders, and so on. And it's important. I think the PAPS, the Pan-African Payment System, I think, is a kind of initiative within Africa to try and make it easier for payments to cross borders just within Africa without having to go through something like the US dollar, right? So you basically create freedom for people to trade without dependency from outside currencies, which I think is...
Yeah, and I think also the issue that you have when it comes to currency is a lot of countries are still pricing against the GBP, the USD. So you pay a lot of money because let's say you want to convert from currency from Indonesia to Malaysia. Actually, the background, you probably need to go against the US dollar. So you pay fees to convert one currency to USD and then again USD to another one as well. So that's why I think in Africa, actually, you have a company called Africanda, and they're trying to move away from this, leveraging the concept of CBDC. I say the concept because it's not really a CBDC, but CBDC and blockchain, to see how they can get away from this. Hopefully it will change. At the moment, it's still painful, but definitely a priority.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Actually, I was I think the best way, if everyone was literate, I wanted to receive Bitcoin or, use, because that's really the cheapest way. If I buy not necessarily Bitcoin, but any digital coins, that was the cheapest way that I transferred my euros into this platform or that I got ringgit back. So, at some point I was actually thinking of that, thinking, okay, maybe I could ask people if they have a crypto.com account, maybe they can transfer this way. That would be much, much cheaper, But then it's about educating people to do that. And I'm still educating myself. So, yeah, I'm not there yet. But seriously, for me, that's the best way
right now. And that's exactly it. We need to use that kind of technology to find a way to make it cheaper. And there are technology solutions. The problem is to do them at scale and so that you get the results. But, one of the challenges, and it is... it's where we need regulators to help as well. One of the concerns is anti-money laundering or, you know, modern slavery, human trafficking, all those kind of negative points on the financial crime side, which come in when some of the controls that are in place, you know, feel like they're being circumvented, right? We've got to find the right balance, I think, on these points. Very, very tricky topic.
And I think for me, like, you know, what you mentioned as well around like experience, right? Using crypto, you need to educate yourself and so on. And we have often this discussion with Michael around like certain other wallets that you have, like MetaMask and how you trade on OpenSea and this type of thing. And I think, like, you know, coming back to your comment earlier, Jay, saying like, women like sometimes like don't accept job as like I'm thinking you were referring to taxi driver because like you know they're scared of taking payments. Well, imagine taking crypto payments, right?
They don't even know that crypto exists in this world. Like I myself, like I just know what crypto is, but like Alison, I have not even, you know, gotten into a place where I would want to learn about it, because suddenly it just feels like, oh, it's over my head. So, you know, I use a lot of digital payments and I do a lot of transactions, but I myself am not in a position to learn more about crypto or, you know, or with the nuances which are coming up in this space, because we suddenly feel like, oh, this is a complete game changer and this is something new. So you just start getting worked up, like, okay, how do I shift from being on the digital this thing to going literally to digital? Is still, you know, there is some money, you know, that it's going, and you get an SMS from your bank that you've received money, you've lost money, and you know, there's so many things attached to it. And like Mike mentioned, there are a lot of regulatory authorities as well which keep telling us that, okay, this is happening. But with crypto, it suddenly feels like cloud computing to me. I mean, coming from a non-technology background, it just feels like, okay, the money is in the air, what would happen? So, and thinking beyond it to the women who are not even gotten into the digital revolution, I mean, for them, it's like, I don't know, maybe it'll take another decade or more than that, but hopefully, as an industry, everybody should start looking at this financial literacy as well. For inclusion, the key is literacy. Yeah,
I think we are very behind on that.
In the case of crypto, I was not thinking for the end user anyway. I was more thinking as what we discussed, Julie, as, you know, having a point like a trusted source, like your organization or my organization or any like organization locally, let's say, with relation to international payment and be able to facilitate international exchange, not for the local economy or using crypto coin, but rather using the infrastructure, the cryptocurrency infrastructure to make international payments. But yeah, I definitely not as a, yeah, here is a Bitcoin, like.
Yeah.
But I think for me, like, you know, you raise a point and like, which is interesting, because like, again, like access to banking could boost like, you know, GDP significantly. I think EY released a report recently and said like it could boost GDP up to 14% for emerging countries and even 13% for frontier market, right? So it's just like, okay, so we know it's something that needs to be done, but yet no one is really doing it right. Because otherwise, like, you know, we wouldn't none of us in this call would feel like actually financial literacy is missing, right? So what is the first step? How can we help the fintech to say, hey guys, like stop applying the 80-20 percent rule when it comes to, you know, UI design and so on, and consider all the requirements, like, how can we help? Like, you know, what is the first step in your opinion on like changing this reality?
So I think, like you said, most of the fintech apps are getting built in the developed country and then moving on to the other geographies. While that is good, I mean, when a product is built, like they say, how how well the marketing is important. Marketing should not just be the focus to get the customer on board to use the app or see how best the app can function, and you can do this in a minute or in a swipe, but also should be on how do we use it, how simple is it to use our platform, and imagine doing things like we don't have to probably say what best your app can be useful, because in today's world there's a lot of competitive spirit and everybody offers almost the same, and then the difference could be some percentage of using a particular digital payment. You may lose 1%, 2%. I mean, I'm just giving a number, but why can't these kind of fintech giants focus on discussing more about the ease of getting into the banking systems or doing financial services using these apps? Like, I think people do speak a little bit about it, but I think you need to make them feel that, okay, this is going to be the next generation thing and we have to be a part of it. So that kind of awareness and literacy, like you have mentioned, literacy is a key. Like today, I mean, I'll speak more from a social sector side or the development sector. Lot of policies have come, but still we want a lot of non-government associations or civic society organizations or even the government when it goes for people. So when we talk about volumes, most of them are from underprivileged or let's say socially a little from a lower economic background. That is where the volume is. And if you want the volumes, then you have to go step down to their level and make them understand as to how it could increase. A very small example of how microfinance banking works in a country like India, where women were never a part of this banking system, like Mike mentioned most of the times. So they are put into these self-help groups, and then they are introduced to this concept of a group loan, which a group can take and everybody gets paying. That is something which they understand very easily. So whether they need the money or they don't need the money, because they are a part of the group, they are engaged or, you know, they are encouraged to utilize those sources, and they know that there is some money in case if there is any emergency. So, you know, I think those kind of innovative literacy program should come up, which goes to the grassroots level as well, and not just for the people who can access access these kind of things. I mean, for anyone like me or Allison, we can just Google and figure out what are the methods, and we can easily within a day, maybe initially it might be a trouble, but within 5 days or 10 days, we can figure out what is the best financial solution for what we are doing, be it for our trips to travel around the world, or be it to run our own organizations on how are we taking in the money or paying it out. Maybe it's challenging in the day one, but we are able to do that. But when we go to the volumes, how can we educate them? How can, like, we see so many, like, by 2030, the sustainable goals are women empowerment, climate change, so many things, right? I'm just saying two things which we follow. So, but why can't it be financial literacy? Like, of the funding which comes, I see financial literacy is just one or two parts. Like, when we look up at the grants websites as well, who keep offering a lot of grants. So every time we get to see that there are a lot of grants for women empowerment, climate change, or rest of the other things. But how often did I see that there are grants for any organizations working in financial literacy? I think it's quite negligible. So I think that definitely will be a game changer.
Great point.
Yeah, I think to your point as well, what's super important, you talked about those group loans, and I've seen that as well in India with Grameen Kuta. And because we need to get back of the reason why banks don't address everyone. Why isn't it inclusive today? Unfortunately, it's just the reality of the business is that it's too costly to reach those people. They are in far rural area. They don't necessarily have identity. They don't have financial scoring. And, you know, they might need a small loan, like, you know, sometimes they just need 20 USD maybe to send the kid to school or to pay for an insurance for their crop, or, you know, so for businesses and fintech in general, but I would say traditional banking, that's the reason why they don't address those people, because it's too costly. So now, why do fintech do it? It's because thanks to technology, they are able to do it at lower cost. But before that, there were exactly microfinance institutions, and they used the power of people and of community to basically have, you know, key points. They use the local community whom they educate and whom they lend the money to, you know, and they have this system to reach out to everyone. And I think that's really, really, really key indeed in financial literacy and teaching and reaching out to those people. But I honestly, I'm not convinced that fintech are the relevant players, because the end goal is different. The end goal is making money, right? So, you know, of course, financial literacy can help them attain that goal. But for me, if we don't bet on the right players, we're going nowhere, you know? So I'm not sure they are an enabler. For me, they're just an enabler.
Yeah, so at the moment, maybe that gap, they've got the technology, like you said, but they go after that market because there's a unserved space, right? And they've got an advantage, but it's not sustainable. And I think that's a problem. We need to be spending 80% on the 20%, not 20% on, you know, 80% on the 20%, you know, whichever way around. We have to invest in the hardest parts of things, and that's, you're right, it's the exact opposite of where you go for commercial gain, right? You go for the easiest targets, the lowest hanging fruit always, because that's where your returns will come, you know. And you're right, I think fintechs will be motivated by the profit incentive, and I really like that you know, Jai's comment as well about like the communities, and you know, it comes back to it's a different approach. And it can't always be a commercial one. It needs to be focused on the greater good if it's to be sustainable.
But, you know, like, Mike, to your point as well, and I do agree with what you said, Mike and Alison, about, like, commercial, like, opportunity. At the end of the day, like, if you want as a business to be sustainable, you need to go after revenue, right? That's having a business. I think like the issue what we see today with the fintech is like they're always targeting the low-hanging fruit. They're not spending any time at all to think, actually, how could I make revenue slightly differently for today, challenge their way of thinking and their way of operating to say, actually, let's think of a business model that can address, like, you know, the volume that Jai was like effectively mentioning. And I think like, yeah, for me, this is what is missing today. Because if you think of like, you know, Grab business model, for example, they targeted markets that no one had targeted before, right? When they launched micro insurance, and what I call micro insurance, say you can pay an insurance per ride and so on. Look at their valuation today. Look at their valuation today. It's like through the roof, like literally through the roof. So I think there are ways to tackle this market in a profitable manner. It's just not low-hanging fruit like weight. And you absolutely need to invest. And it's going back to your 80% time on the 20%, Mike. Spend some time on it to find the business model. And there are some, I think.
But that's also the reason why, you know, because as I was thinking about, you know, funding some women and so on, and, you know, seeing as well what Jai was doing and thinking of how, because, you know, those women, they will learn, but then, you know, they might have a problem with the bike, or they may not have the money to buy a new one or whatever. And I'm a strong believer in the power of individuals. I think that there are many things we cannot control in life. And, you know, the strategy of fintechs, of banks, me, certainly, I can have an opinion, but, you know, I cannot really change them. So, but I really believe that there are many things we can do as individuals. And that's why, for example, I'm asking, of course, sometimes I ask companies if they want to sponsor and so on, but that's why I'm asking individuals and people, like, would you like to sponsor this woman? Or, you know, because I was thinking, for me, if I have a stable salary, I don't mind giving like 1,000 euros for 6 months to a woman in India that she will reimburse in the next year with no interest, because I'm not a bank. That's not my business. you know, but the impact that it can have on this person is huge. And for me, 1,000 euros, you know, over 1 year, she brings, you know, she sends it back. And, you know, I know it's a woman from the organization of Jai, so I can trust that if there's any issue, you know, Jai will guarantee it or whatever. But, you know, I've been thinking about that. And it's the concept of peer-to-peer loan. But again, it's the infrastructure that we need, you know, the infrastructure, the enabler behind it. And that's why I'm so frustrated at the moment with all those payment options, because it's really reducive in what we can do.
Something we have to change. We've had a good discussion. We're probably way over time. I know we are. However, I really do want to carry on. Can I ask one more question? One more question. Maybe, Julie, should we cover one that's a little bit topical now that we're coming to the end of the pandemic, hopefully, you know, switching gears. I just wondered from both of you, what you think the effect of the pandemic has been on kind of women's inclusion. Do you have any thoughts on that to share?
Yeah, I would want to go for this. So I think pandemic has put women off the track in many, many spheres, and unfortunately, the financial world has become way more difficult for the women to get back on. For people like us, yes, we understood or we learned the best practices we can have and utilize the utilize the benefits of being financially included and be able to access most of these financial apps what we get. But on the other hand, when we talk about the women who do not have access, they have been like earlier, they would at least go to a bank or a small savings scheme run by the government. And in most of the houses where women don't get to save their money, like in India earlier, be it my parents or grandparents, we always know that my grandmother would have some money in her food container back in the kitchen somewhere. Like, you know, she would just go into the summer holidays and somebody would pick, because that was a safe space for a woman. Like, they know where to save it. It's not that they don't want to include it in the family's income, but they always save it for a rainy day. And thankfully, everybody moved on to the space of microfinancing and banking and some saving schemes, which is more like an institutional thing where they could go and put their money and they know it is safe. Now, when the pandemic happened, none of these women had access to or know how to download their bank's app on the phone and use that. So one is they stopped that savings, because in that 2 years, it was very difficult for them to have that space. Where do they store or save their money? And second is, how do they go back and access those funds in case there is an emergency? They didn't know how, they couldn't go to the bank, and not everybody could use an online banking thing. So I think that had a huge impact on a lot of women. We should just be, I think I always feel that we are very, very fortunate that we are in a space that though pandemic happened, it didn't stop. We didn't stop living. I mean, most of the things were still the same for us, and in sometimes better, but for many, it's not the same.
Great point. Alison, anything to add?
I think, yes, for sure. I mean, the pandemic, and it's well proven in everything you read about gender equality, that the pandemic has pushed us backward, because obviously, you know, a lot of low-skill manual jobs that were fulfilled by women have been stopped. And, you know, in the low-level tourism industry as well, I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's like more than 50%, I think it's 54% of the tourism manpower are actually women, not necessarily in the high-level jobs, but still. So definitely the economic impact, for sure, and I see that as well in Malaysia. But I would also add the mental health impact. So that's often a little bit forgotten as well, because again, in our cultures, we have psychologists and we talk about well-being and mental health. But in many countries, in Asia in particular, and in Malaysia as well, at least where I see it, it's a very taboo topic. So we forget about that, like those women, even those who work and who had to care, you know, for the kids. And I'm not even talking about the woman who had physical violence. So I used to volunteer as well for a Women AIDS organization. And I've seen the number during the pandemic, how the numbers have jumped through the roof in terms of violence, of domestic violence on women. That's what frightens me most, because imagine when you cannot even go out of your house, even if you know how to ride a bike, you cannot even take it and go somewhere. You're stuck there.
There's nowhere to hide.
And that literally gives me like shivers. Like thinking of that is just really, really frightening. So for me, that's the biggest, definitely impact of the pandemic.
Wow. You both mentioned, we haven't spoken too much about what you do in enabling the mobility of women. We've spoken quite a lot about payments. I guess it's a payments podcast. But I was wondering if, when we publish this, we can make sure to put some links to what you guys do and how people can help, to make a difference if they want to find a way to support your cause and drive it. I think we definitely should have a way to kind of help people reach you. And support the great work that you're doing and the positive example that you're setting to empower people and make the world a better place, right? Make it a more equitable place for everyone.
Well, I mean, if there are any women riders or aspiring riders in the audience, maybe they can join Jai and myself on a motorcycle tour, because we have partnered indeed to organize a woman-led motorcycle tours in India, where we could visit the school that Jai is building and, inspire local women and get inspired by them as well and contribute to their economic activities there. So obviously this trip has had to be postponed a few times, but we're not desperate that will happen one day. So any aspiring women riders or women riders, like stay tuned and you can meet both of us in India, in Telangana, hopefully next year.
Yeah, for people who've been stuck at home for too long and want to get out and experience the world, here's the perfect opportunity, right? Brilliant. Oh, well, I'm inspired by you both. Thank you so much for your time today, for the excellent discussion. It's really been lovely to talk about this topic, a very, very important topic. And we'll definitely make sure people can find you and contribute and partake in your inspiring work.
I think of us are on
LinkedIn. They could reach out to us on LinkedIn. And if anybody wants to see what we are doing at Movo, you've already checked our website just as we were speaking, so you could just put up the link to our website to continuously know what we are doing or where we are going, and that would give them some idea on how they would want to support us. Support doesn't always have to be monetary. Like, if somebody wants to come and say that we want to do financial literacy to the people whom you're teaching, because that's one vertical we teach our women. Apart from mobility, we also teach them financial literacy. So, if anybody says that, we want to take care of that part, it could be anything. So a website is the best way to know about what we are doing. And we are also active on most of the social media, like on Instagram and Twitter as well. So it's easy to reach us out there.
Fantastic. Thank you.
I hope today's discussion shed some light for you on women's inclusion. If you enjoyed this discussion, please give us a thumbs up, hit subscribe, and click on the bell to get notified when new content arrives in the future, or share the podcast. Also, don't be shy about giving us feedback. We really appreciate your comments and suggestions for topics and guests. This is a Wet Compass Labs podcast, and we believe that there are two types of payments, good and bad. At Wet Compass Labs, we exist to help open the doors of finance to all and to protect those who enter. To achieve this, We leverage our deep expertise and unique payments technology to support financial services institutions with their payment transformation. That's all for today. Catch you on the flip side.